Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Well, good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. This is Randy Fine, your show host. So, you know, lately, these days, we're all very familiar with yoga and meditation. It's kind of mainstream. I know years ago, it was such a new kind of thing for the Western world, and when it was introduced, it was so exotic and everything. But the thing is, do we really understand what is behind the science of yoga, or, you know, other than just being an exercise or meditation just being for relaxation? There truly is a science behind it. And today we're going to learn about that. We have with us Leonard Perlmutter, who is the author of two books and founder and director of the American Meditation Institute in Avril Park, New York. And he's going to be talking about his book, The Heart and Science of Yoga, the American Meditation Institute's Empowering Self-Care Program for a Happy, Healthy, Joyful Life. This 500-page, newly revised and expanded comprehensive encyclopedic guide to meditation and the yoga science behind it corresponds with his Empowering Self-Care Program of the same name, which since 2009 has been certified for continuing medical education credits by both the American Medical and American Nurses Associations. Leonard Perlmutter, a direct disciple of Swami Rama of the Himalayas, is one of the Western world's leading pioneers in the introduction of meditation into the cultural firmament. Over the past 39 years, he has served on the faculties of the New England Institute of Ayurvedic Medicine in Boston, Massachusetts, and the International Himalayan Yoga Teachers Association in Calgary, Canada. Very impressive resume. So let's meet him. I'll introduce him to you and we can get started. Good morning, Leonard. How are you?
I am very well, Randy. Thank you for the invitation.
You're so welcome. It's wonderful to have you with me.
Great.
So before we went on air, we were just chatting a little bit about this, about how this book came to be.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that to my listeners?
Well, the book really came out of my teaching in 1996. Swami Rama, who was my meditation teacher, instructed me to start teaching. And essentially, Leonard has a very shy personality. I really didn't feel confident to hold myself out as an authority on the science of yoga. But since I was instructed to teach, evidently my own master thought that I was qualified. So I sat and contemplated for a week or so to try to figure out, well, what is it that I'm going to teach? And the only thing that I really felt in my heart that I had the authority to teach was what I practiced. And so I began sitting down in 1996 in front of my brand new computer, the first computer I ever got, and I just poured out on pages on the computer what I practiced every day, the meditation, the breathing practices, the Ayurvedic medical principles that have helped me become a healthier person, easy general yoga that has been excellent for both my mind and my physical structure, as well as other esoteric practices that act as diagnostic tools, such as an understanding, a rudimentary understanding of the chakra system. And from that initial curriculum, I began teaching. And from the classes, my students taught me even more. And I added that to the curriculum, and slowly, a book developed.
Wow. So, you say, well, actually, in your introduction, you talk about how 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, the pioneers of modern yoga science had stresses. They were different than what we have stresses now, but they did have stresses of their own. And this began by these men and women embarking on this journey of self-inquiry and self-discovery, and experimenting with scientific meditation techniques. So can you tell us a little more about how all this really began?
Well, I guess it began, like most change begins, with some form of pain. Thousands of years ago, people, they didn't have computers, they didn't have automobiles, they didn't have airplanes, they didn't have a lot of the modern technological gifts that we have today, but there were a lot of similarities, so not much has changed. In other words, they had to deal with fear that they might lose what they have, fear that they might not get what they want. They experienced anger when desires were thwarted. They had desires to be happy and to be healthy and to be secure. And certain women and men who were curious enough, they realized that if they kept on doing what they always did, the same consequence would develop. And so they began thinking to themselves. They sort of had, I'm assuming, scientific-oriented minds. And they probably said to themselves, look, why don't I just change the equation that I'm using? Why don't I change my thoughts? Why don't I change my words? Why don't I change my actions and see what happens? And they did that. And increasingly, very similar to the way the compassionate Buddha developed his enlightenment, is that they began to trust themselves, not just experts outside of themselves. They began to trust their own intuitive wisdom. And as a consequence, they felt better. They felt better physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. And at a certain time, about 400 years before Jesus the Christ, Patanjali, this sage in India, codified this oral tradition that went back 5,000 to 6,000 years. And Patanjali codified yoga science, and it became an ongoing lineage of teacher and student, teacher and student. And my master presented the teaching to me, and I am presenting it to the world through this book, The Heart and Science of Yoga.
Very, very cool. So is it still evolving?
Well, the interpretation is always evolving. The truth is eternal, but the situation is that every human being is living in, really in a separate universe and experiencing the universe in an entirely different way from everybody else. So we, each of us, each human being has an obligation to access this truth, to see what it means in our relationships today. So it's sort of analogous to the fact that we're asked not to deify the teapot, but rather to drink the tea.
Interesting.
If there's this old knowledge, it doesn't do us any good if we just honor the knowledge and we revere the knowledge. We have to put it into practice, and that forces us, if we're truthful with ourselves, it forces us to examine our own interior mental forces. I'm talking about fear and anger and self-willed desires. And ask ourselves, are we willing in a certain relationship to give up the fear, give up the anger, give up the selfish desire so that the relationship can be more rewarding? And so that is part of the scientific experimentation that takes place in every relationship, every day, through the science of yoga. So yoga is essentially a science. It's a template, if you will, for experiencing happiness, health, and security. You know, yoga science is the oldest mind-body medicine in the world. It's also the origin of every single religion. But to begin to practice yoga science, each of us must make a decision. We must make a decision whether we are going to be willing to use our own mind-body sense complex as our own personal laboratory to undertake scientific experiments. And if the answer is yes, we are willing, then we need to build what we refer to as the bridge of yoga. The bridge of yoga, it's a metaphoric bridge, if you will. Of course, yoga means union. And the bridge of this yoga, this union, connects our outer actions with our inner wisdom. So we know from our own experience, from Newton, his third law of motion, that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So what are the actions that we're going to take that are going to bring about a consequence that are going to bring us health, happiness, and security? And that requires an examination of our mind. It's very powerful. Our thoughts are so powerful. What we think becomes what we say. What we think becomes what we do physically in the world. And all of those, our thoughts, words, and actions, bring about consequences that can lead us to the happiness and the contentment and the health and the security that we deeply desire, or simply delays the prospect, and instead we experience physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual dis-ease or pain. So the key to successful living is to recognize that we are actually citizens of two worlds, the physical material world and the world of consciousness and spirit. If we can bridge these two worlds in every relationship, we can access what yoga science refers to as the superconscious portion of the mind. The superconscious portion of the mind is beyond the conscious mind. It's beyond the unconscious mind. It's the same portion of the mind where Albert Einstein saw mathematical equations. It's the same portion of the mind, this superconscious portion of the mind, where Paul McCartney hears beautiful melodies. You know, Randy, it doesn't mean that you're going to become a songwriter. It doesn't mean that Leonard's going to become a physicist or a mathematician. What it does mean is, if we can counsel within before we act without, if we can go within, use that bridge of yoga to access this superconscious wisdom, and then take that wisdom that is now in our conscious mind and employ it through thoughts, words, and deeds, the consequence, and this is the hypothesis, the consequence is certain to bring us happiness, health, and security to the fullest extent possible without without pain, without misery, and without bondage. But the opposite is true. The corollary to that is that if we don't have a philosophy of life that connects our outer actions to our inner wisdom, then what develops is conflict between those two, between our thoughts, words, and deeds, and our own inner wisdom. And that inner conflict is the mother of all problems.
I think we can all relate to that. I mean, that is so logical. It makes great sense. So how do we tap into that? Is this through yoga and meditation that we can tap into the superconscious mind?
Yes. Meditation is the key. So first of all, everybody meditates all the time, but we're just not aware of it. Meditation is simply a one-pointed focus of our mental energy. And we experience that many, many, many times a day, many times a week, any time that we're doing something or have a relationship that we love. So it could be an ice cream cone that we're experiencing. It could be a trip to Las Vegas that we're experiencing. It could be a wonderful movie that we're experiencing, or a great book, or a fantastic concert. When we experience these things that we claim to love, we really love it because our mental energy is focused exclusively on that object to the exclusion of everything else. Okay, so there are no interceding thoughts trying to pull my attention away or change the channel. And that's why we love it, because of that stream of one-pointed attention. So in meditation, we learn the skill of how to direct our attention in a one-pointed manner. Okay, so that's the first skill we have in meditation. The second skill that we gain in sitting for meditation is we learn to create a space between stimulus and response. So when we meditate and we meditate on a mantra, and I can talk a little bit about that later, but when we give our full attention to the mantra, the mind is habituated to stimulation. And after 15 or 20 seconds, the ego and the senses and the unconscious mind, they get bored. They want to change the channel. That's why we have thousands of channels on cable TV. It's why we have a zillion channels on the Internet, because the mind is addicted to change. But in meditation, we just give one object, the mantra, exclusively to the mind to give attention to. But, of course, the mind gets bored. And so a thought comes forward. Hey, what's for dinner? Now, food, I love food. I could think about food just about any time of night or day. But if I do that, if I give my attention to this uninvited thought that is now interrupting my attention toward the mantra, I'm not meditating, I'm thinking. So I have a new relationship. And that relationship has to be dealt with before I can continue meditating. So what meditation trains us to do is to create a space between the stimulus and the response. The stimulus in this particular case is food. I'm thinking about food. It's a new thought that is competing with my directing my attention to the mantra. So if I have a space between stimulus and response, that provides me freedom to redirect my attention to one of the four major functions of the mind that's called our conscience. Now, we all know that we have a conscience, but we're not really taught about its functionality. The conscience is what separates human beings from every other animal. No other animal has a conscience. We have a conscience. What is the conscience? Well, the conscience is the function of the mind that operates like a mirror. It has a reflective capacity. And what the conscience reflects is perfect wisdom from the superconscious portion of the mind. That's what it does for a living. The conscience can access wisdom from the superconscious portion of the mind that is currently outside the matrix, our everyday matrix of our mind-body-sense complex, because we don't rely on that wisdom like we should. But through meditation, because I have created a space between stimulus and response, when an uninvited thought comes into my awareness, the space between stimulus and response provides me freedom to redirect my attention to my conscience. The conscience can reflect wisdom from the superconscious portion of the mind, and then it reflects it from the superconscious portion of the mind into the conscious mind. And in that situation, while I'm meditating, what the conscience is telling me and suggesting to me is to sacrifice this thought right now that is competing with your attention towards your mantra. Sacrifice it. And if I can base my outer action on this inner wisdom and actually sacrifice my thinking about food and then bringing my attention back to the mantra, I am creating not only one-pointed attention, but by creating a space between stimulus and response, I'm creating the tool of detachment. I'm learning how to be detached from things that are pleasant and attractive and familiar. And I'm also receiving discrimination. I'm building the skill and the tool of discrimination. And because I actually listen to my inner wisdom, I'm also building the muscles of willpower. So every time we sit for meditation, we are honing the skills of one-pointed attention, detachment, the space between, you know, stimulus and response, discrimination, and willpower. And when I finish my meditation practice, I have these tools. I have one-pointed attention, I have detachment, I have discrimination, and I have willpower to base my outer actions on my inner wisdom in every relationship. And gee, it makes life very enjoyable and very rewarding because I can use these tools in every relationship.
Very cool. So years ago, I learned to do transcendental meditation. And it sounds, you know, knowing what that is sounds very similar to what you're describing, because there are different kinds of meditation. But is this all transcendental, or are we talking about a variety of kinds of meditation?
Transcendental meditation is similar to yoga science. It is part of yoga science, but it is not the complete science of yoga. At a certain point, Maharishi made a decision that Americans at that time were not really qualified to take on the entire science. And I think that probably that was a legitimate conclusion on his part. The reason that gentle yoga, physical postures, is now so popular and was the first appearance of yoga into our culture, the reason for that is that we have a very physical culture. So it was very logical that yoga postures would be first to come into our conscious awareness in this culture. So when the Maharishi came along in the late 60s and early 70s, he asked folks to just concentrate on a mantra. But there's a far greater aspect to yoga science, and that is a coordination of the functions of the mind to make conscious discriminating choices.
Okay.
You see, the mind moves first and the body follows. So if we can coordinate the mind to only think certain thoughts that have the good housekeeping seal of approval of our own conscience, known as Buddha in Sanskrit, known as Holy Spirit in Christianity, if we can defer to this wisdom that is within us, that is us, then the consequences will make life poetry and song.
Beautiful. I love the way you explain that. That's awesome.
Oh, good, good. Well, that's important, right? It's important.
Yeah, no, it is. It is, you know, because I was, as you were talking about the process of mantras and meditation and creating that space, you know, I was thinking to myself, I was remembering back in my training and just being told to sort of just kind of ignore the intruding thoughts and just kind of keep focusing on the, you know. But we were not taught to create that space. Yeah,
that's
okay.
Right.
So,
that's right.
So that I noticed that difference. Okay.
And the mind has... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, the mind has four functions. In addition to the conscience, we have the ego. And the ego is always defining things as pleasant or unpleasant, good or bad. And another function of the mind has to do with the senses of sight and smell and taste and hearing and touch. Another function of the mind is the unconscious. So the unconscious, the ego, and the senses, they all have limited perspectives. Sometimes that limited perspective is correct, so we don't want to get rid of any of them, okay? But we need to educate them. We need to educate them to not to a limited perspective, but to a holistic 360-degree panoramic view that only the conscience has. So Patanjali, who codified yoga science thousands of years ago, said all yoga, all union, all happiness, all health, all security begins with an understanding of and a coordination of the functions of the mind. Because, you see, the mind moves first and the body follows. Would you like to do a little scientific experiment, a yoga experiment?
Sure.
Okay,
yeah.
And we can invite all the listeners, too, to do it.
Okay,
so this experiment actually has two parts, part A, part B. So let's do part A first. So I'm going to ask you, Randy, simply to raise your right hand directly over your head and then bring it back down again. Go ahead. Try that.
Okay.
Is that doable?
Doable.
You can do that, right? Okay,
yes.
Great. Okay. So you know it's possible.
Yes.
Okay, so part B. I want you to do the exact same thing you just did. I want you to raise your right hand directly over your head and then bring it back down. But this time, there can be no thinking.
Okay.
Allow the hand and the arm to go up and down by themselves without ever entertaining a thought. Go ahead, try that.
I did it. Okay.
Are you sure? No thinking.
So you're telling me I'm thinking.
That's right.
I don't think I'm thinking. Let me do this again. Yeah, I guess there is thought involved in that. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's so subtle. It's so subtle. We're really not consciously aware of it, but the arm and the hand. And the hand cannot move unless and until there's a movement in the mind. The mind moves first, you see. The will force of thought allows the muscles to contract in a certain configuration so that they rise and they come back and that comes down. Without thinking, it's not possible to take an action. And yet all actions bring about consequences that lead us in one direction or the other. So it would stand to reason that if we could examine our thoughts and only serve those thoughts through speech and action that have the good housekeeping seal of approval of our conscience, those actions will bring about consequences that will lead us for our highest and greatest good, as opposed to dis-ease, pain, stress, burnout, and worse. And that's what the science of yoga is about. It's a recognition that we are the architects of our lives. We determine our destiny. And our most powerful resource is our thoughts. You know, we hear a lot of chatter in the culture about junk food. And that's an important thing to examine. But even worse than junk food is junk thoughts. If the truth be known, We don't examine thoughts to determine whether they're in our best interest. So one example that has been very powerful for me is recognizing now at this point in my life, I do not eat food that I love. I eat food that loves me.
Interesting.
And because the food that I now eat loves my liver, my pancreas, my eyes, my heart, my lungs, my ears, because this food loves me, I love it. But if it were just the ego and the senses and the unconscious mind that says, oh, let's eat this because because we love it, well, that's not good enough for me anymore.
What a great mindset for, changing your, physical, your health and your physique.
Absolutely,
your body,
and that's what yoga
everything.
Is all about. Yoga is about changing our concepts, because our concepts skew our perceptions.
Okay.
You have a lot of faulty concepts stored in the unconscious mind. We all do. We learned when we were very young that 1 + 2 = 3. But we've all had teachers that told us that 1 + 2 = 4. And we were so naive and we were so impressionable, we believed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I today have that faulty, untrue concept stored in my unconscious mind. And don't you know, in certain circumstances, in certain relationships where my emotional buttons are pushed, 1 + 2 = 4 is my go-to concept. And every time I employ that concept in thought, word, and deed, I hurt myself.
Mm-hmm.
So yoga science teaches us how to examine these faulty concepts and change them.
This is so intriguing. It's very simple.
It's just common sense.
Simple but complex, because it's so different from what we're used to doing.
That's right.
So, chapter 3, you say, based on our memory, the only truth about ourselves that we can declare 100% is, I am. What do you mean by that?
Well, we define ourselves every day in many different ways, with many concepts. So who is this I? What am I relating to when I say me or mine, these personal pronouns? So if I examine who I think I am, I might consider myself tall or short or heavy or thin or angry or forgiving or fearful or fearless, happy or sad. I might be a teacher, I might be a student. But all those ways in which we define ourselves, they always change, don't they? Because I remember when I was small, but now I'm tall. When I was a child, I was heavy. Now I'm thin.
Right.
Some days, I'm angry. Some days, I'm calm and forgiving. In some certain circumstances, I'm fearful. And in some circumstances, I'm fearless. Sometimes I'm a teacher. But sometimes I'm a student. So these ways, these concepts that we define ourselves by are always changing. And in yoga science, when we ask the question, who am I, we're not interested in the relative truth. We already have the relative truth, and we're still in pain.
Right.
That's why we're looking for a solution, that's sort of outside the box. So if we're honest with ourselves and we sit ourselves down and we contemplate, if we contemplate that I am-ness, I am, and we ask ourselves, based on our memory, was there ever a moment, was there ever a day, was there ever a week, was there ever a month, was there ever a year, was there ever any time when that I am was not true? And of course the answer is, it's always been true. It's always been true. So there's something about us that has never changed. That I am-ness that is within you, Randy, that is within Leonard, is part of an ocean of consciousness. It's the background of all reality, into which gross and subtle objects appear for limited periods of space and time with which we have a relationship, with which we must act, which bring about consequences. that can lead us in one direction or the other. So this I am-ness, this beingness that is within each of us, is part of an ocean of consciousness, the background of all reality into which gross and subtle objects appear for limited periods of space and time, with which we have relationship, with which we must act, which bring about consequences. So right now, Leonard is a gross object appearing in Randy's awareness, just as Randy is a gross object appearing in Leonard's awareness.
Okay.
The chair you're sitting on is a gross object appearing in your awareness. Your own body, Randy, is a gross object appearing in your awareness. So you have a body. It's your instrument of action, but you are not the body.
Right.
That's right. So you change your perspective, you change your experience. That's what yoga science is all about. Changing perspective, you change your experience.
Okay. I love this stuff. This is so amazing.
Yes, I love it myself.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. You know, it really cuts to the core of all the issues that we suffer in the physical world.
Yes, and all the differences that we have, all these contentious political differences, it cuts right through them all.
Yeah, it really does.
It connects us to the unicity that underlies all the diversity.
Yeah, wow, amazing. I like the way you said that, too. So we're talking to Leonard Perlmutter and about the Heart and Science of Yoga, which is his book and also a program, an empowering self-care program. So, Leonard, maybe I've missed something that's important to, you know, to stress, and we have about 4 or 5 minutes to cover whatever you think might be important.
Well, what I would like to leave the folks with are two things. First of all, I have no intention of convincing anybody of anything. I'm sort of Johnny Appleseed. I'm just planting seeds here. So if what you hear sounds interesting, I'm simply asking you to experiment with it. Turn your entire mind-body-sense complex into a laboratory for your experimentation. Because if you just listen to me, that's just hearsay, okay? And you'll still have doubts, and you want to go beyond doubt. And the only way to do that is to experience something for your own self. So yoga science provides a template for experimentation so that you can learn to know the truth, who you are, from where you have come, why you're here, what's to be done, and where you will go when the body dies. So toward that end, the take-home message right now, I guess, would be remember that every thought that comes into your awareness, every thought is only a suggestion of what to give your attention to. It is not a command.
Oh, I love that. I'm writing that one down. So every thought
is only a
suggestion of what you should give your attention to, right?
Right. And your conscience, the buddhi, Holy Spirit in Christian terminology, will tell you 24/7 what is the thought to think, what is the word to speak, and what is the action to take that will lead to the consequence of happiness, health, and security. So what we're asked to do is to bring yesterday and tomorrow into today, then bring today into now. Now, at this auspicious moment in this relationship, a thought comes into your awareness. Are you going to serve it in speech and action, or are you going to sacrifice it? Don't ask me. Don't look in my book, you see. Do what Shakespeare asks. What does Shakespeare say? Above all else, to thine own self be true. Be self-reliant. Cultivate an intimate relationship with your own inner wisdom and just see what happens. I know what happened with me. I felt better physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, and that's why I'm teaching.
This is so inspirational for all of us. You know, a lot of my listeners, because I one of the things that I do is counsel people who have had trauma through relationships with personality disordered individuals. And so there's a lot of pain, a lot of pain, and a lot of things that I myself am a survivor of it. So a lot of things that we hold on to.
Yes.
But it doesn't define us, and I think this is really an important message for everybody who's listening.
That's right.
That what we can cut to the core and sort of surpass all that pain and all the things that have happened to us and that we're holding on to. So I think that's an amazing process.
You know, there is one
process.
Thought, mm-hmm. and I don't know whether we have time for it or not. Okay. And that is that even people who are abusive for whatever reason toward us, they're our teacher. So there's a concept in yoga science called guru. Guru is very often misunderstood. Guru is a universal force of light that dispels darkness. It's present in every relationship. It's present in the person with whom we have a relationship, and it's also present within us as our inner guru. The person with whom we have a relationship, whether it's personal or secondarily through the media, that person, through their actions and their suggestions, is the outer guru. So when the outer guru is in harmony with the inner guru within us, the outer guru, the outer teacher, is to be honored and respected and served in mind, action, and speech, and will be led for our highest and greatest good. But when the outer guru, the relationship that we have, is in conflict with the inner guru, is in conflict with the inner guru, the outer guru is still to be honored and respected as a manifestation of the supreme reality, but because the outer guru's suggestion is in conflict with the inner guru, it is incumbent upon us to reject that teaching, because at that moment, that person, that relationship, has come into our lives to teach us what not to do.
Yes. Yes.
And that's why
I
tell people that one of my most important gurus is Elvis Presley. Because when I was 10 years old, I fell in love with Elvis Presley. I loved him when I was 10, when I was 20, when I was 30, when I was 40, when I was 50, 60. I'd love him today.
Oh.
And because I loved him, I gave him my attention.
Okay.
And because I gave him my attention, I observed some of the choices that he made that conflicted with my own inner guru.
Okay.
And so
we're going to have to stop. I'm so sorry. I like that analogy, but we're going to have to stop because I just want to give you a second to say where you can get the Heart and Science, where we can purchase the Heart and Science of Yoga, and how we can get in touch with you.
Thank you very much. Well, the website for American Meditation Institute is americanmeditation.org. americanmeditation.org. You can purchase the Heart and Science of Yoga through our website. Of course, it's on Amazon, it's at Barnes & Noble, all fine booksellers, but our portal is the americanmeditation.org. The book is there, our classes, online streaming, videos, retreats.
Okay, great. So that's your hub. That's where we can get all of this. Okay. Well, I want to thank you. This was such an inspirational time together with you, and I know I feel a change in me. I like this perspective, so I'm enjoying this, and I hope others are as well. I'm sure that others are as well. But thank you so much for being my awesome guest, and
thank you for being my awesome host.
You are so welcome. You are so welcome. I enjoyed it. So
thank
anyway, have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. So we are out of time. But my final message to all of you is, may joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randi Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randigfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randi G. Fine.